This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you joining us this afternoon for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort that joins us live by Skip Us on the podcast, if you'd like, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That is where we have the chat room. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, we'll be monitoring that. So you're free to put your thoughts there. And if there is a question you would like to us to direct to our guests, you can also put it in there, and we will do our absolute best to integrate that into the show for the next hour. And if you've got to take care of some business and you want to catch up on what you missed, remember you can always subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes, Spreaker, or any of the other aggregators out there for podcasts. But let's go ahead and dive into today's show. And we're going back to a topic that, at least on the maritime side of the house, it better be on your short list of topics you talk about a lot. And that, of course, is China. And with China, we continue to see her expand her holdings and presence in the South China Sea, among other areas. And when you look at the first and the second island chain, you can roll into that, the Belt and Road Initiative. China is not standing still. She's looking for her future and what she needs. We've also seen, for those that like to count units and items, they have a really unmatched shipbuilding program that are expanding not just their traditional Navy, but also their Coast Guard and their maritime militia that we'll go into a little more detail as the show goes forward. And to get us those details, we've brought on a returning guest today to expand on the conversation we had this fall, and that'll be Hunter Stiers. And if you've been over to my home blog or on the show page for the live show, you'll find a link to what we're going to use as kind of our touching point and kickoff point for today's conversation. That was his 2018 U.S. Naval Institute General Prize winning essay titled "The South China Sea Needs a Coin Toss." He also has some other related articles on the topic that we'll bring into the conversation as well. Hunter is a fellow at the John B. Hattendorf Center for Maritime Historical Research at the U.S. Naval War College. He focuses on maritime strategy and logistics in the Western Pacific. He's also an associate of Central Gulf Lines, a division of Sea Corps Holdings, and is a graduate of Columbia University. Hunter, welcome back to Midrats.
Sal, Eagle One, it is great to be back. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Hunter, and you bring a lot of good topics to bring to about something that we usually just hear bits and pieces of, or people refer to it as weekly, or one of the questions I may ask later on, we've been talking about for so long, some people have tuned it out. But even if people have tuned out China has not tuned out them. So at least here on Midrat, we're going to keep coming back to it. And as kind of a kickoff question, I wanted to point the listener again to your general prize winning essay, because unlike a lot of work that kind of has a nice warm up, you start the essay really strong with a point right to the forehead of the discussion. And I'll just go ahead and quote your first sentence. First sentence of your article of "The South China Sea Needs a Coin Toss" is, quote, "The present U.S. approach to countering incremental Chinese aggression in the South China Sea has failed," end quote. And for the listener, if you could outline a bit, what are those lines of operation that the U.S. has been using to address Chinese incrementalism, and how have they failed?
Sal, that's a really good question. Thank you so much. And thank you for the kind words about the article. Frankly, you mentioned in terms of we could actually start with in terms of one of the key words that I use in this particular sentence, which is the word approach. The alternative that might otherwise be substituted in here would be strategy. And the reason why I didn't use the word strategy is because we don't seem to have one. At least we haven't for the past maybe a little bit under 10 years. The primary line of effort that we seem to that the United States seems to be using to try to influence events in the South China Sea in a favorable direction, it has been really freedom of navigation operations. And right now, freedom of navigation operations, they are, as my mentor at the Naval War College, James Holmes, wrote recently, they are necessary, but they are insufficient. And right now, we do them periodically, but we don't do, frankly, to the point that they are insufficient. There's not much else going on that I can perceive. We're starting to get into a better place in terms of get more towards where we need to go in terms of filling out other lines of effort that we can talk about those later. But really, I mean, what essentially this article is trying to accomplish, and in terms of putting forward the strategy, this new strategic concept of maritime insurgency and maritime counterinsurgency, is to help kind of reframe the discussion and help us reorient ourselves to and reorient our strategy as we seek to engage with this particular set of challenges.
One of the you have to take a global. I know we've done this before, but let's talk about the global picture. One of the problems we seem to have is that the U.S. and its allies, and in fact most of the civilized world, have said, okay, we're for freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas, and China's view is different than that. Can you kind of run over the difference in the Chinese view of what, at least in the South China Sea, their view of the seas is?
That's a really important point to raise, and that is a key area of difference that's vital to understand. So essentially, since more or less the beginning of the Republic, the United States has been a major proponent, and we've considered it to be an essential national interest. We've considered the freedom of the seas to be an essential national interest. And this is in large part because a result of our geostrategic position as essentially an island power. We depend on seaborne transportation to access the overwhelming majority of the world's population and associated markets. And when we talk about access, that's military access, that's economic access, political access. We've got across an ocean. So we want to make sure that we and other maritime powers throughout history have wanted to ensure that ensure our ability to reach these key nodes. And whereas China, as a continental power, is essentially extending a continentalist terrestrial vision of maritime sovereignty out into, in this case, in the South China Sea, this notion of blue national soil, the idea that you can own distant ocean areas that aren't anywhere near you. So that is and this is something that, we've seen challenges to freedom of the seas before, but in terms of, the United States has fought no less than 6 major wars throughout its history, in which the freedom of the seas has been a declared U.S. aim. And this is something that I think in the current day and age, not enough Americans necessarily realize. that, as we see kind of currently sort of a narrow, in certain quarters, a narrower conception of what U.S. national interests are. Well, maintaining the freedom of the seas globally, which has been this accepted principle, this has been key principle, as we talked about last time, this has been a key principle in international law since the 1600s. And since 1945, it has been increasingly accepted and promulgated and eventually codified through the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. And so now we are seeing China is essentially pushing back against that, and that is, as I argue in the companion piece to the South China Sea News, the Coin Toss, this article, and online, it's why we defend free seas. The global architecture of the freedom of the seas, which we consider a codification of customary international law, if that is eventually undermined, as Chinese efforts in the South China Sea are undermining it, that would be really very bad for the United States in particular. It would be bad for everyone, but especially for us.
You had me thinking there when you talked about China as a continental power. When you look at the USA has been, and at least in the modern context, is a maritime and aerospace power. But since World War II, you can argue that on occasion, and we're kind of doing it right now, but at a very low level, we've tried to play continental land power in Asia to varying degrees of success. And China is traditionally a continental land power, but in the modern era, she has very distinct maritime needs and requirements, which is that Belt and Road. We also, the latest kerfuffle in the Straits of Hormuz and Sea of Oman. Everybody's rushing to defend U.S. interests, but it's actually Asian products that were headed that way. And as we have had difficulties working as a continental land power in Asia, with China's breakneck building of a blue water navy in the last 15, 20 years, especially, she's learning and she's stretching. Is there a danger that she could make some of those clunky oversights going into an area that's not traditionally theirs at sea in a similar way that we have done on land?
Well, Sal, I think that's a really interesting question because, in a way, China. One of the things that's fascinating about this particular challenge at the present is that China actually depends on the freedom of the sea more than anybody, and yet they are the leading power that is singularly undermining it, and. And if they're not careful, the outcomes for them are not necessarily particularly good either. Because China, as has been discussed elsewhere, very effectively, China is extraordinarily dependent on its on very extended key lines of communication to access, particularly hydrocarbons, which flow predominantly from the Persian Gulf, as you mentioned. If the freedom of the seas goes away, if essentially other countries start to follow China's lead in undermining the rights of other countries to use their coastal waters, start trying to assert increasing rights in things like exclusive economic zones, increasingly terrestrial territorial rights. China could find itself very much, it might not like that particular outcome. So I think a big part of what I argue should be, this U.S. and allied maritime counterinsurgency campaign is about not only defeating denying China any additional gains in terms of in its efforts to undermine the freedom of the sea in the South China Sea. It's also about convincing them that actually the freedom of the sea has worked for them. I mean, China, I mean, this freedom of the sea's regime, international, liberal international order that the United States has led it and underwritten since 1945, it has brought more people out of poverty and oppression than any other period in human history. And a lot of those people are, in terms of, you know, being lifted out of poverty, are in China. And it is, you know, China's ability to, you know, access international markets through its, you know, its reform and opening. It really, I mean, you can look, it's perhaps you could, I mean, they would like to, you know, the Chinese Communist Party would certainly like to take credit for that. Well, really, that was the result of the U.S.-led maritime global system that they chose to, integrate themselves into. And now they are cutting at this foundational pillar. When we talk about globalization, what we are really talking about is the growth of seaborne trade. And when the Chinese are attacking that, I mean, that is that will ultimately be detrimental to their interests. The other component of what they seem to be trying to do is perhaps to try to put more of more trade, especially, you know, towards Europe, on overland trade routes through the Belt and Road Initiative. And that's something that the United States should be particularly concerned about, because if indeed the Chinese are successful at undercutting the freedom of the sea, and if they then are able to shift more trade into overland routes, well, that's something that the United States, as maritime power, is going to be fundamentally cut out of, and we will be on the outside looking in of that particular world. So it is very much an imperative for the United States to take action to arrest this progressing this threat to the freedom of the sea, and essentially one of the key it is an absolutely fundamental U.S. interest.
All right. Well, let's talk about what China is doing in the South China Sea, which I think you've already said blue dirt, if you will, blue land, whatever they want to call it, and how they are enforcing what they view as their rights in that area, and what the U.S. and its allies should be doing about it.
Well, I think the key dynamic that is at work in the situation in the South China Sea, which the Chinese have been very effective at acting upon, is this idea of the battle of legal regimes. And we talked about this briefly last time, but to offer some additional detail from the last conversation, essentially, what's now transpiring is you have this contest between, you have on the one hand, you have the regime of international law of a free and open maritime system of the freedom of the sea, represented by UNCLOS, underwritten by the United States and its partners. And on the other side, you have China's vision, which is written into its own domestic law and various provisions that seek to codify restrictions on foreign rights of navigation in what China claims to be, it claims to have indisputable sovereignty over, within the Nine Dash Line. And then it seeks to restrict, foreign military activities within its exclusive economic zone. And, things of that nature. And it seeks to, so these are the two contesting legal orders that are now contending in the South China Sea. And the so if we are fighting over who governs, which of these regimes will govern in the South China Sea, we are fighting over whose laws are enforced. And the decisive dynamic in whose laws are enforced in the South China Sea is going, and frankly, in any insurgency, counterinsurgency conflict, when you're fighting over whose laws are enforced, the fundamental decisive element is whose laws do the civilians follow? And if, do they follow the recognized international legal regime that we would like to see to be enforced, or are they forced to submit to Chinese depredation on their lawful rights, their internationally guaranteed rights and privileges to be able to operate and navigate where they choose in international waters and enjoy their own country's exclusive economic zones. And the Chinese have been very effective at acting on this decisive dynamic of whose laws the civilians follow, because they are targeting specifically targeting civilians. And there are 3.7 million people who are dependent on access to the South China Sea for their daily livelihoods, you know, through employment in fisheries, resource extraction, etc. And the South China Sea is the home to half the world's fishing fleet. This is a major civilian population that we don't generally think of the seas as being a place where you have a large resident civilian population. But here we actually do see that. It's not just some kind of flat, featureless plain where nobody goes and has contending naval forces in it. It's something closer to a Mahanian force-on-force confrontation or major fleet action, etc. Here, it's really about there is this intermediate interface between in this battle of legal regimes. It's really about the relationship of the belligerents with the civilians rather than the actions of the belligerents that are directed against each other. And this is something the Chinese seem to recognize. I mean, it's well established in their strategic canon. The two major Chinese strategic theorists are Sun Tzu and Mao. And what the Chinese are doing is they're kind of fusing these two together, where if Sun Tzu's overriding point is that when possible, it's always better to win without fighting, and then Mao's concepts of insurgency and revolutionary warfare, that's what you see, and the concept of controlling the people, and that's what we're seeing happening here. And we are simply absent, not just in terms of our presence, but also when we do show up, we are so focused on things like freedom of navigation operations. We're perhaps overly focused on the expansion and proliferation of Chinese forces in the area, such as through their island building. We're not focused enough. We've been largely ignoring the civilian populations that are navigating this area a lot more than we do. So there's just more of them. And if we continue to neglect them, we neglect them at our peril. Because if the Chinese continue to say, the Americans might come through, they'll drive by with one of their destroyers within 12 nautical miles of a particular reclaimed maritime feature that we have now fortified. Well, if the United States then leaves, that is a very inconsistently applied influence to counteract an opposing influence that is applied, perhaps, certainly doesn't have enough force. I wouldn't send on a China Coast Guard vessel against, the American fleet. But if the American fleet or the American service combatant isn't there most of the time, then whereas China Coast Guard and the Chinese Maritime Militia, backed by the PLA Navy, if they are there all the time, 99 versus 1%, something like that, which side are the civilians going to be compelled to listen to? They have to, because the civilians are there continuously. And if they perceive that we aren't there, and if they see that we aren't there, as we very much, by virtue of geography and necessity, very often we're not, then we're going to be in a lot of trouble. So what the concept of maritime counterinsurgency seeks to accomplish is, okay, what can we do to be there and be present and show that, in fact, no, the rules have not – communicate to civilians that the rules have not, in fact, changed. And if we can manage to do that, inexpensively, sustainably over a long duration of time and effectively in a credible way that the Chinese cannot simply kind of either run over with, some kind of, direct attack or something that just simply just is missing the target as we've been continuing to miss the target. If we can manage to sustain a long-term effective but low-end presence backed by higher-end combat forces, to protect them, that could be a far more effective way of communicating, fighting for the legal regime that we would like to see enforced.
Yeah, I want to just emphasize that point because when I read it in the article, I could almost hear some people yelling at you, apostate, heretic, blasphemy, as the pitchforks and torches came your way, because in most operations, you always have to be concerned that your habits and your desired tactics aren't something that actually help your opponent. And you're pretty clear in saying that U.S. thought ops, as opposed to actually signaling U.S. national will, that they're helping China and helping them make their case. And you just mentioned offering, that we needed something, a longer presence. And I think what goes into that as well is we've also seen from Japan to Australia and all the Western Pacific nations in between, a fair bit of hesitancy to join the U.S. even on our temporary forays into the FONOPS arena. So, your proposal to look at options to have a more longer-term presence, for that really to be effective, wouldn't we have to work on getting the nations of the Western Pacific to get involved in that continual presence as well?
Absolutely. I mean, there's really no way to effectively do this alone. And without effective buy-in by the people whose civilian mariners these actually are, whose waters and whose exclusive economic zones these actually are. I was frankly expecting more pushback than I have received. I mean, I've been fortunate that this received a generally pretty positive perception, but frankly speaking, it's not exactly a very exciting prospect to say, let's go and send Americans out to be on the front line for Filipino and Vietnamese fishermen. That by itself is not necessarily the most exciting prospect. If, on the other hand, we can integrate with these countries and with the Philippines, the Vietnamese, these players actually do bring some really important low-end capabilities to the table. Where right now we have, the U.S. Navy is an all capital ship force right now. We are acquiring some, highly effective low-end combatants like the Mark 6 patrol boat, which could be, extremely valuable. But first of all, we're just, we're pretty far away. And unless we've got, local partners who are willing to work with us on this, and work together to accomplish this, and then we're going to be in a bit of a tight spot. So finding, and it's also an issue where with the resource constraints of the U.S. Navy's all capital ship force, you don't want to be sending, you know, some of the most powerful combatants in the world to go to essentially be conducting these very low-end presence operations. You want the high-end combatants in position to do what they do best in a kind of a high-end deterrence position. You want to minimize their involvement in operations for which they're potentially, you know, not very well suited. You know, these kinds of lower-end missions. So, you know, those higher-end combatants, they're really good to protect the guys who are doing the low-end presence work. But we've actually seen with, I mean, the British had a very interesting experience in the Cod Wars, which is a very, very interesting case study, where essentially Icelandic trawlers and converted trawlers as, you know, fisheries patrol vessels more or less beat the Royal Navy and, you know, the Royal Navy's, you know, high-end anti-submarine frigate, a very significant force of them. Iceland more or less won that fight and or that contest. Thankfully it wasn't a full-on shooting war, but in that game of bumper boats, trawlers beat warships. And so that is something where, you know, the warship's already expensive, and it's also not very well suited to that particular mission. Well, then maybe that's not the best asset that you want to deploy. So the question then is, okay, well, what do we bring to the table? Is it something like, Mark VI patrol boats? Is it our corvettes? LCS could be very happy doing this kind of mission. As one potential option, I'm no fan of the 57 millimeter gun, but in that kind of situation where if you have, you know, a lot of, you know, small vessels within the range of that particular weapon, which has a very high rate of fire, if things go badly, that might be a capability that actually might be pretty well suited to that particular mission. So this is something that, in terms of trying to right size, okay, what exactly are we committing? We don't want to make. We want to find a way to, you know, put in forces that are, you know, well suited to the challenge, and at the same time not going to break the bank. And then the other aspect of it, in terms of, you know, having local partners, it's not just also the kind of the principal agent problem. It's also an issue. It gets back to the resource issue of we want to max, you know, get the disproportionately large effects for our input. So that's where one of the cases that I bring in the proceedings article, the South China Sea's coin toss, is the Marine Corps' Combined Action Program versus the Viet Cong, where essentially during the Vietnam War, the Marines deployed these quote-unquote combined action platoons, where a Marine rifle squad of 12 guys, so 12 Marines integrate with a South Vietnamese home defense platoon of, you know, 35 kind of home guard, more or less, and, you know, to together form this kind of combined unit, that the Marines raise the effectiveness of the local this local force, and at the same and importantly, they're able to work in it, actually with a higher degree of effectiveness at protecting local civilian populations from the Viet Cong and Viet Cong reprisals, because they are also not just you know, savvy from a resource perspective of, you know, we're putting in 12 Marines and we're getting out 44 person unit. Essentially, I mean, you know, this is a, you know, the figure is that, you know, you're putting in 2,200 Marines and you're getting out a force of 20,000 at large scale. So that's more people than in the Marine Division. Not only are you being resource savvy, you're also creating a force that can be present among civilians and essentially contesting in that battle of legal regimes. In this case, it's the rule of the U.S.-backed South Vietnamese government that we want to enforce rather than the dictates and the depredations imposed by the Viet Cong. The command action platoons were actually significantly more effective than other proposed and practiced tactics and operational concepts that were preferred by William Westmoreland and Marine Military Assistance Command Vietnam, of large unit battalion-sized sweeps through different villages. The problem with these large-scale sweeping operations is essentially the battalion is – you only have so many battalions. So they're going to come through an area and then, very similar to a freedom of navigation operation, they're going to come in, they're going to stay for a few hours, and then they leave. And the Viet Cong might have, 12 armed guys against, several hundred Marines or soldiers of the U.S. The Marines or the South Vietnamese Army or the U.S. Army or the South Vietnamese Army. It's 12 against, hundreds. Well, in that case, the Viet Cong is going to decline to fight, obviously. They know they would lose in a straight-up fight. But the battalion is there for only a couple of hours a month, and the Viet Cong is there the rest of the time. And from the perspective of the local civilians, they are faced with a situation where they would, in many cases, they would vastly prefer the regime, the South Vietnamese regime, and that is their preference. And this whole, and yet, even though it's kind of a reversal of the idea of that fortune favors the side with the bigger battalions. In this case, quite literally the opposite. If the bigger battalions aren't there, then whoever is there and is exerting a commanding influence and is able to, enforce its will and enforce its law and authority, that's the side that's going to prevail. And so the combined action platoons are much more effective than the battalion size sweeps in that particular case study. I mean, in terms of they did studies of in terms of civilian population security, they had consistently higher scores. They managed to inflict disproportionately higher casualties on the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army. For a casualty rate lower than that experienced by large-scale, units engaged in large-scale operations. So, and at the same time, the math worked out that you would have a countrywide combined action platoon concept, so implemented across nationwide would require a fraction of the overall force that ended up being deployed to Vietnam, which I recall was something like 500,000 soldiers and Marines. So, thinking about how we can apply the combined action platoon case study to contemporary challenges, if we can find a way to integrate U.S. forces with local forces, like the Philippines Coast Guard, for example, or the Philippines Navy, and get a small input of U.S. units, potentially a few American patrol vessels, some American officers working with to help train the Philippines Coast Guard, that could be highly effective. And this is so one of the best new developments that I've seen recently is when the U.S. Coast Guard deployed one of its national security cutters to the South China Sea. They were conducting exercises with the Philippine Coast Guard off Subic Bay, where you had one big American vessel and you had three or four Filipino vessels. And at one point, they were conducting operations where they were helping, you know, assisting a local Filipino fisherman in distress. And the Chinese actually, you know, they generally they were present, they were shadowing them, but they were also kind of keeping their distance, which was also interesting. So if there is a way that we can, you know, essentially, you know, for a limited input of ships and personnel, a limited cost input, and get a much larger output through local partnership with, you know, countries like the Philippines and Vietnam, along with, you know, other countries, Brunei, Indonesia, Malaysia, that could be a highly effective, resource sustainable model for us to contend in the battle of legal regimes.
Find my mute button. Well, I saw that Representative Mike Gallagher and Representative Jimmy Panetta have submitted a bill to sanction the illegal or counter the Chinese aggression of the South China Sea. So, in your view, I guess that would be the, once again, a legal framework saying, look, what you've done is illegal, and then you would couple that with this counterinsurgency type program.
I think from the sound, I don't think I've seen the bill specifically, but you said it was a sanctions regime.
Part of this is a press release. Free and open access to the South and East China Sea is critical, both regional security and international commerce. Through its illegitimate efforts to build and militarize islands of the region, the Chinese Communist Party has aggressively attempted to control those critical waterways and undermine international law. Legislation makes clear that any individual or entity supporting these illegal actions will be held accountable. Blatant violations of international law must be confronted. This bipartisan legislation demonstrates Congress's intent to discourage malignant destabilizing activities in the Indo-Pacific region.
Yeah, that's definitely an excellent, definitely right on that, Congress is taking note and expressing its displeasure at the actions that have been undertaken. To the point about sanctions, I do think one of the key takeaways from, in terms of looking at not just the Combined Action Program, but also, the other case study that I discussed in this article and in my recent piece that just came out in the Naval War College Review, of the U.S. Asiatic Fleet's Gray Zone Deterrence Campaign against Japan between 1937 and 1940. One of the key takeaways from those two cases is really the importance of combining deterrence by denial with deterrence by punishment. Relying on either one is really insufficient. If you adopt a deterrence by denial posture of really putting forces forward to deter the adversary at the point of attack, in the gray zone or otherwise, potentially, William Westmoreland's counter argument to the combined action program approach, as he said, if you were to fan out your units all across South Vietnam, then they would be exposed to being defeated in detail. And on that point, that's true. But then on the other side, if you say, okay, we're just going to do deterrence by punishment, we are going to focus really heavily on the high-end fight and preparing for that and making sure that we are ready to go against, in a large-scale, full-throttle contingency against a pure adversary. In that case, the adversary is going to say, follow Sun Tzu's dictate, if I can get what I want without fighting, and without triggering your massive response, well, then I'm going to try and do that. And in which case, you will have lost the, you know, what you were trying to protect. And you had prepared for a war that, you know, it didn't come, but you still, you know, failed to achieve your objective. So it's really critically important to balance the two together. So, you know, in the Vietnam case, one of the key elements is having quick reaction forces ready to go. In the Asiatic Police case, it's ensuring that both the Asiatic fleet is up to strength and prepared to protect Americans at the point of attack and kind of the denial side of the house, and then also making sure that the U.S. fleet or the Pacific fleet, which is back in California and Hawaii, is ready to intervene on a larger strategic frame if the forces that are executing deterrence by denial come under attack. And, you know, in the case of the Asiatic fleet, Washington essentially neglected its forward-deployed force in the Western Pacific, to a debilitating degree over the course of the interwar period. And by the time that the Asiatic fleet went to war in 1941, its final commander, Thomas C. Hart, he noted correctly, it was factually correct that his ships were old enough to vote. And in that era, that was quite old for a warship. Arguably, it still is, although we now are extending the service lives of our ships out to 30 to 45 years and 50 for our carriers. So it's critical to have that balance, so that you're not over-investing in something that could get easily run over by a sudden attack. And at the same time, you're also not over-investing in something that potentially you're going to be you're neglecting the possible gray, kind of quote-unquote gray zone avenues of attack that you might face. If you're so focused on that high-end fight, that you don't necessarily take action or prepare for other lower end contingencies.
In your related article that went out back in May, Why We Defend the Seas, I have a little long quote here I wanted to give you a chance to flesh out, Hunter. And that has to do with, I remember back at USNI West, I think it was 2010, there was a great panel that had Captain Fennell on it. It also had a JAG Captain, Stu Belt. And what Stu brought out was talking about, and again, this was back at the start of the decade, about one of the ways that we should confront China is through lawfare, and trying to tie them up on all the legal requirements for international trade and at sea, et cetera, and so forth. And this little paragraph from your article had me thinking about it. And here's an extended quote for the listeners who haven't had a chance to read it. Quote, from you, Hunter. Quote, China is working to replace this free, open, and rules-based maritime order with an unfree, closed, and hierarchical continental one through the maritime insurgency. If China is allowed to succeed, the Sino-centric world that would follow would be a dark place. If recent behavior is any indication, Chinese leaders desire to see their country reside at the center of Eurasian and global trade and politics, superior to all others, with lesser states meek and subservient to the Middle Kingdom. End quote. In that line, if China continues to show their own special type of contempt for the international order that they see they didn't have any part in writing, what are the limits of the concept of using lawfare to restrain them? And is there other concepts? I think you've brought up a few of them that we should look at extending efforts on instead.
Well, I think it's this sort of underscores that it's really important to defend the international order that we have. This was one that just incidentally you mentioned in terms of the Chinese. You know, certainly enjoy like to say that this was something that was created before we were kind of before we were powerful, before we had any kind of a say. Well, scholars of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea have and of international maritime law more broadly, they point out that China's delegation to the UNCLOS conferences, where the treaty was drafted, they played a critical role in defining some of the key terms in terms of the key dimensions of, I want to say it was like the exclusive economic zone as one example, but don't quote me on that. But the Chinese delegation was indeed heard, and the Chinese position was certainly incorporated into the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and this is one that China has benefited from, an order that China has benefited from immensely. So, what you would see in terms of what seems to be, if you kind of draw out where is this, the end, if we can extrapolate what the desired end state seems to be from kind of the likely end state of, what China's activities seem to be headed towards. What China seems to be trying to accomplish is they're not necessarily trying to say, okay, nobody can navigate that up. What they seem to be trying to accomplish is that nobody else has a right to be there, but for our sufferance of it. You are there at Beijing. That other country civilian mariners, they are there in places like the South China Sea, waters that China claims for itself. They are there only at Beijing's pleasure, and if they might be perfectly prepared to countenance, other country civilians if those countries, essentially kowtow and, acknowledge Chinese supremacy and certain sovereignty over certain waters. And you see that especially with the Philippines, where the Chinese were putting a whole lot of pressure on the Philippines under the Aquino administration, and then Duterte comes in. He has a much more sycophantic line with respect to China, and all of a sudden the Chinese ease up, and they allow. So you see it in particular places like Scarborough Shoal, where the Chinese, they seized that particular maritime feature. They kept Filipino fishermen out, and now that there's a pliable administration in Manila. Now the Chinese are allowing Filipino fishermen back to Scarborough Shoal to fish, but they're not allowed inside. They're only allowed on the outside of the reef, where it is. They're not allowed inside the lagoon. They're getting essentially the dregs of the fruits of this maritime feature that is well within the Philippine exclusive economic zone. So it's this to me is kind of illustrative, and I just a quick shout out to the Philippines Press, which has been really exemplary in reporting on these issues in a highly effective way, getting out on fishing vessels, filming the China Coast Guard as they conduct boardings, as they take catch, they take equipment, and certainly. We see now, there's currently a major political, you might go so far as to call it a political crisis in the Philippines over a Chinese vessel that rammed and sank a Filipino fishing vessel. And then after the Filipino crew is, you know, dumped into the water by the sinking of their boat, the Chinese vessel doesn't stop. They just leave. You know, violating the fundamental law, the fundamental principles of, you know, kind of, you know, talk about the law of the sea. You know, it is the law that when there is an incident at sea, that when there are people in the water who, you know, are in people, mariners in distress, the closest vessel has to stop and you know, assist them and render assistance and pick up survivors and all of that. And the Chinese didn't do that. They just motored away, and they offered a, you know, incredibly poor and easily refuted excuse as to why they did. They claimed that there are so many Filipino vessels around. Well, no, there weren't, because if there were so many Filipino vessels around, then why did the Filipino fishermen get picked up hours later by a Vietnamese vessel, which, you know, promptly arrived at the scene and, you know, rendered assistance as is, you know, right and proper and legal, and is, you know, that is what mariners, you know, are required to do. That is the case of the Philippines is certainly it seems to be kind of a bit of foreshadowing as to what the Chinese seem to have in mind if they do indeed succeed at getting recognized legal jurisdiction over this particular area. And I should note, in terms of this point of, you know, legal jurisdiction versus kind of military preponderance, military dominance. Of course, the South China Sea is, you know, closer to China than it is to, say, the United States. There, you know, the main strength of the People's Liberation Army Navy is based at Hainan. Of course, Chinese vessels are going to be probably more preponderant than other countries in that area. That's fine. The problem is when China starts to say, yes, well, we own all of it, and never mind the rights of all of these other coastal states, of the Philippines and Vietnam, and your rights to have, you know, exclusive economic zones. No, we own all of it, even though there is, you know, never mind the fact that there is no historical basis for China to claim this. I mean, the Chinese claim, as Bill Hayden has most admirably pointed out, the Chinese claim is as old as his parents and my grandparents. You know, it was first articulated in, you know, sometime in the 1920s. The Chinese government was unaware that the Spratly Archipelago even existed. So that is so again, this is we're seeing a foretaste of what the Chinese seem to desire, and it really underscores why this is something that the United States should really seek to oppose.
With the sound of thunder behind Sal's microphone.
I have it muted. Well, I'm trying, but yeah, I'm glad I finished my arc earlier today. I might need it.
Well, it's we're coming up on the on our time limit for this show, Hunter, and it's been really interesting, because I always look at what China's doing as, you know, let's make China great again. And they're always harking back to their 100 years of humiliation. And you know, they look at how the Western world, the Brits and the other colonial powers, developed their empires. And, you can see that they're kind of pushing against that envelope. And you know, the historical background for a lot of their stuff is just what was done to them in many ways. I mean, it looks like you can make that argument from their point of view anyway. What comes next for you on looking at the Chinese South China Sea problem, or are you moving on to different matters?
Well, I think there's a lot of work that remains to be done in terms of figuring out how do we operationalize this? How do we make, you know, solving these persistent questions of how do we maintain a sustainable presence that is effective at contending and defending the freedom of the sea in this part of the world? How do we interface with partners? How do we work together to accomplish what we need to? How do we maintain deterrence over vessels that we are trying to protect? What are the responses that are open to U.S. and allied forces in the event that this is challenged, as it will surely be challenged? So this is something where there's a lot left to do in terms of figuring out these tough questions. So I plan to continue working on this, both from kind of the strategic perspective, the logistical perspective, all of these different dimensions of the challenge. I'm excited at the prospect, and welcoming to anyone who's prepared to engage to solve this problem of importance. I think if we can really engage the community of thought that is active in this space and vibrant in this space. We've got a lot of smart people thinking about this, and if we put our heads together, we are certainly going to prevail. So, looking forward to carrying on the development and advancement of the strategic concept and beyond.
And Hunter, thanks again. It's been a pleasure as always having you on board, and look forward to the next conversation.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hunter.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. I hope y'all have a great July 4th. And as always, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way.